It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's the true difference between the sexes. So are females always the nurturers and males always the hunters and gatherers? Our guest is naturalist Susan Alport. She is author of Primal Feast, Food, Sex, Foraging, and Love. While the Stearns are into Hot Truck, a deeply localized specialty of Ithaca, New York, wine maverick Josh Wesson talks a crucial wine and food combo, what to drink with corn on the cob, then Dory Greenspan checks out the best ways to save that wine you couldn't finish, and we have the story of a local hero and his giant tomato. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Now sit up straight, Kate. It's time to eat, Pete. Have a banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy. Get with the gravy, Davy. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Try a tomato, Plato. Here's cacciatore, Dory. Taste the bologna, Tony. Everybody eats when they come to my house. I fix your favorite dishes, hoping this good food fills you. Work my hands to the bone in the kitchen alone. You better eat if it kills you. Pass me a pancake mandrake. Sample a taco, Paco. Have an hors d'oeuvre, Irby. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Hannah, Davy, Tommy, Dora. Man, drink. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Pasta, Fazula, Cholula. Oh, do have a bagel, Fagel. Now, don't be so bashful, Nashville. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Hey, this is a party, Marty. You get the cherry, Jerry. Now, look, don't be so picky, Mickey. Everybody eats when they come to my house. All of my friends are welcome. Now, don't make me nag ya, mag ya. Eat the tables, the chairs, the napkins, who cares? Eat all my things if they gag ya. Have a frittata, lata. Nibble a kibble, sibble. Chili con carne for Barney. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Face, busta, share, chops, thump. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Steak, cake, pie, side, juice, root, tart, bart. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Next Friday night, you're all invited to dance from 8 to 3. All the fishies in the sea are having a ball. It's some affair, they'll all be there from the herring to the whale. They'll turn out to shake a scale in Neptune's hall. Come along and follow me to the bottom of the sea. We'll join in the jamboree at the codfish ball. Lobsters dancing in a row, shuffle off to Buffalo. Jellyfish sway to and fro at the codfish ball. Finn and Hattie lead the eels through an Irish reel. The catfish is a dancing man, but he can't can like the sardine can. Tuna's trucking left and right, snappers tapping, what a night. There won't be a hook in sight at the codfish ball. Octopus and albacore, 50 miles away from shore. Tango cross the ocean floor at the codfish ball. Minnows dance the minuet, barracudas pirouette, while the stingray plays his clarinet at the codfish ball. The Scottish salmon form a ring and dance the Highland fling.
the music's hot, so the lock, stock, trot, and the halibut is the jitterbug king. Sing it with me now.
Cut my long and follow me to the bottom of the sea. We'll join in the jamboree at the coffee ball. Lobsters dancing in a row, a shark pull up to buffalo, jellyfish sway to and fro at the coffee ball.
Finn and Hattie lead the eels through an Irish reel. The catfish is a dancing man, but he can't like the sardine can.
Tuna trucking left and right, snappers tapping, what a night. There won't be a hook in sight at the coffee ball.
At the codfish ball. At the codfish ball. Da, 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 da.
Yeah. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by Super Target. Today, it's food and the sexes. We have a naturalist's take on how gender shapes how animals eat, including we humans. Our guest is Susan Alport, author of Primal Feast, Food, Sex, Foraging, and Love. Well, wine maverick Joshua Wesson takes us to Heaven's Gate with his summer special, Wines That Love Sweet Corn. Gadget guru Dory Greenspan checks out the best way to keep any leftover wine. Then it's the story of a local hero and his giant tomato. And as always, in the second half of the show, we are going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine.
Lynn, we recently went to Ithaca, New York, and learned a whole new culinary language. It is the language of hot truck. For example, if you would like a sandwich on garlic bread with tomato sauce, mushrooms, sausage, pepperoni, and mozzarella cheese, order a full suicide, known to Cognoscenti as a suey. You might want a wet suey, which means extra tomato sauce. You might want a suey high carbon, meaning run it through the oven a couple of times so it's nearly blackened. This is a whole language devoted to this wonderful mobile eatery called Hot Truck. Not the Hot Truck. Nobody ever uses the before it. Hot Truck in Ithaca, New York.
Now, is Hot Truck, let's start at the beginning here. What is Hot Truck?
Hot Truck is a place. It is also what you eat at this place. In other words, if you're in Ithaca and you get hungry for one of these fabulous French bread pizza type sandwiches, you say, hey, let's go get some Hot Truck. And you go to the Hot Truck, which has parked on the Cornell campus, and you might have to wait in line, for example, 30, 40 minutes, sometimes an hour at the height of the, when a lot of students want to eat there. After an hour, you get these stupendously good sandwiches that some people in Ithaca say really were the prototype for Stouffer's French bread pizzas.
This is one place. Now, is it really a truck?
It is really a truck. It drives away about 2 in the morning. It pulls up at 9 p.m. It drives away mid-morning. However, the really good news for those of us passing through when school is not in session is that there's a place in Ithaca called Shortstop Deli, open 24/7, 365 days a year. And at Shortstop Deli, they make exact replicas of Hot Truck sandwiches. In fact, condoned by, endorsed by, and endorsed by the official Hot Truck.
Now, I'm still blurry. Are these like pizzas? Are these sandwiches with two slices of bread? What are we talking here?
They are French bread pizzas. In other words, you take a half a loaf or a full loaf of really good kind of Italian bread.
Right.
Slice it in half and then top it with whatever ingredients you want. You order it. They run it through a kind of, it's a broiler with a tread on it. The sandwich runs very slowly under the broiler and out it comes kind of sizzling hot with maybe a sausage added to the top of it after it goes through the broiler. If you're like me, you'll have it run through twice and it'll get really crusty.
So Jane, what does the Hot Truck look like?
You know, I have no idea.
I'll tell you why. Because my
Jane was drunk.
No, I wasn't drunk. I was in bed.
Let me just say parenthetically that it is said that hot truck will either kill or cure you if you really have a load on and need to deal with it late in the morning.
Well, I did not have a load on. What happened is Michael and I went to a wedding, and after the wedding, there was this phenomenal dinner with hors d'oeuvres forever, and then a sit-down five-course dinner and dessert and cake. And after all of this got through at 11 at night, I was staggering. I had eaten so much, and I was so exhausted. I went to our hotel room. Michael pops up, you know, like he just woke up. He said, "I'm going out to eat hot truck." So I said, "Dear, goodbye." I went to bed.
And went back
but
to...
But I'll tell you, I wish I had eaten hot truck. It sounds fantastic.
So what is, Michael, what does this look like? I mean, is it an Airstream trailer?
No, it's more like a bakery van, you know, the kind of sort of enough room in it to have one of these mobile ovens so they can cook the hot truck there. However, being merely a truck, they can never make more than they can make. And that's why you sometimes have to suffer through a line of an hour or more.
Or you go to the shortstop deli.
Or you go to the shortstop deli where sodas are 10 cents a glass.
You're
with
kidding.
Hot truck.
No. 10 cents a glass.
My mouth is hanging open because Michael said they leave at 2 a.m. And as he put it, in the middle of the morning. that's because Michael wakes up at 2 a.m. And, you know, to me, that's the middle of the night.
I have this picture that if you're in a strange town and you see this tall guy in cowboy boots sort of wandering around with a searching look on his face, it's Michael looking for the local version of hot truck. Hey, guys, thank you.
You're welcome, Lynn.
That's with a hungry look on my face.
Yes, exactly.
Goodbye.
Exactly. Shane and Michael Stern are authors of Road Food. Now, you hear the Sterns here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're checking out the site, don't miss out on our free weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. Every week we send you a new recipe for a fast supper dish, technique tips, and shopping info. It's all free, and all you have to do is sign up, splendidtable.org. Wine maverick Joshua Wesson was a sommelier who turned his life around. He went from hyping pricey bottles of gorgeous vino to hunting down superb sipping for pennies. He's the creator of bestsellers wine shops, and he comes to visit us every single month. Josh, good to have you back.
I love you. I love being here.
That's nice. So what have you been working on? What have you been tasting?
Well, you know, it's corn time, so I always love to absolutely, you know, make the most of whatever is seasonal. And I've got a friend who I sponge off of, my best friend. He's got a house out in Amagansett in Long Island. And three blocks from his house is the most magnificent cornfield. And they let you pick your own corn so you can get the water boiling. Back at the house, you pick the corn. The sugar doesn't have any time to convert to starch. And it's just, I can't get enough of it. I eat it morning, noon, and night.
But you drink wine with your corn, don't you?
No, not in the morning, but starting at noon, it's fair game.
Okay.
And because I tend to eat a lot of corn just, you know, straight on the cob, either steamed, boiled, or I love grilling it over some charcoal. I love serving wine with it. And people always seem to think that corn is, like most vegetables, problematic when it comes to wine. But it's the easiest vegetable in the world to pair with wine because it's got such a dominant taste of sweetness and nuttiness. And those two factors, those two taste elements, pair with a wide range of wines.
So which ones would you be using with the corn?
Well, when I steam the corn or boil it, And I tend not to use butter. I'll use a little bit of sea salt just to act as a counterpoint to the sweetness. I love nutty, rich Chardonnays that are New World Chardonnays. And by that, I mean anywhere but France or anywhere in Europe. Wines that really taste to the sun that usually have a kiss of residual sugar or so much fruit that it suggests sweetness.
Mm-hmm.
And Australian Chards in particular are great for this, as are California Chardonnays. And if I steam it or boil it, I'll look for a wine that doesn't have a lot of oak because I don't need that toastiness coming into play. But if I grill corn, which is really the way that I enjoy it most, with a little bit of burnt nuttiness that accompanies that sweetness and richness. I like Chardonnays that have a suggestion of oak to them. And Hope Estate Chardonnay is one of my new faves from Australia. And it's barrel-aged, partially barrel-aged and barrel-fermented, and it picks up some of that smokiness and nuttiness. And it's just one of those you can't stop. You get messy, and your glass gets messy. You don't care if the glass is all covered with corn bits and pieces. And, you know, your face is covered with corn because you're just in it. You're in the season, and it tastes so good.
Well, I've just invested, you know, maybe $4 in the dozen ears of corn. What am I going to invest in the wine?
Well, the Hope Estate's $14.
And, oh, it's not bad.
No. And you don't have to spend that. You could get a Kendall Jackson, which has a little impression of sweetness, for around $10. Their Vintner's Estate, and that's really, really good with just steamed or boiled corn. And, you know, corn doesn't cost much. There's no reason to spend a lot of money on the wine either. That would be out of character and out of season, too.
But what, all right, now what about corn dishes, like corn chowder or, you know, corn with cream, that kind of thing?
Well, when you amp up the richness by adding butter and cream, it's a good idea to find a wine that isn't commensurately rich, but rather goes in the opposite direction, that has a lot of fruit, but has enough lightness in body, or enough acidity, or in some cases, actual bubbles to cut through the richness of the butter and cut through the cream. I love corn chowder, and I love corn soups made with cream. And I had a fantastic wine from Chandon called Riche. It's their entry into an extra dry sparkling wine. It's about $18 a bottle, and the scrubbing bubbles just act, you know, like a, you know, a, this phalanx of, you know, little cleaning people brushing away all the richness and scrubbing the cream off the palate so you can have more. You know, once you start with corn soup, you can't stop. You can't get a ladle big enough. I use an entrenching tool. You know? But when you have that with a sparkly wine that has a hint of sweetness, my God, you're two steps away from heaven's gate.
And that Chandon's from California, right?
It is.
Chandon's in California. Are there any others?
when I make too much corn, which is rare, but occasionally it happens, I will strip the corn right off the cob using, you know, the end of a knife, and I'll make corn relish. And I'll put some, you know, red peppers in there and maybe a couple of other things, some sweet onions, and let it sit for a day or two. And then I'll serve it next to grilled fish or grilled pork or any kind of lighter meat. It's fantastic with scallops. And when I have these dishes, whether they're served cold or hot, I look for white wines that have no wood, that have a little bit of sweetness, that have acidity to make them, that keep the, in a way, the whole dish from cloying or overwhelming the palate. And one of my favorite matches from a grape perspective is Chenin Blanc, and one of my favorite Chenin Blancs for summer lurching into fall is from South Africa. It's from Simonsig, Simonsig. And it's made near Stellenbosch. It's $10 a bottle. It's the wine that I bring out to my friend's house in the Hamptons, because at $10 a bottle, I don't care if people drink a case in a weekend. You know, there's no worries.
Yes, exactly.
And it goes with a corn relish sitting next to just about anything that corn relish could sit next to, and it's magnificent.
Josh, I'm heading out to get the corn. Thank you.
Save an ear for me.
Well, Joshua Wesson is president and co-founder of Bestsellers Wine Shops. Now, you can get his sweet corn wine picks on the website, splendidtable.org. And while we're talking corn, I have got to tell you about El Burrito's Corn on the Cob. This is a Mexican market in our town that does killer corn. And here's how it works. They roast corn with the peeled back husk so that it can be used as a handle later. As it roasts, it's basted with butter. Then once it's done and cool enough to handle, they slather it with Mexican sour cream. But the big finish is coating it with Parmesan cheese and hot chili powder. It is the drippiest, the messiest, the most outrageously good bite off of a cob you're going to get all summer. Now, I've written up my version of the recipe, so check out Lynn's drippy Mexican sweet corn on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, a naturalist take on why females focus on food while males focus on the females. Saving that wine and open lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can find them online at target.com/SuperTarget. Remember the book Men Are from Mars, Women Are from Venus? Well, that got us wondering if there were real differences in how males and females of many species, not just we humans, react to food. If gender figures in communication, it has to play into how animals feed themselves. Well, we invited science writer and naturalist Susan Alport to join us. She's author of Primal Feast, Food, Sex, Foraging, and Love. Susan, welcome back.
Oh, thank you for having me back.
So, Susan, is there really a difference between females and males when it comes to food?
Incredible difference, because basically their reproductive strategies are so different, and that's reflected in their relationships to food. Females have invested in large eggs that then they tend to go on to nourish. Males have a very different reproductive strategy. They've invested in much smaller sex cells, the sperm, which have no nutritive capacity. And so basically, though food is important to both of the species, as we well know, everybody needs food in order to survive. For women, for females, it's more important than it is for males. Females spend most of their time looking for food. Males spend most of their time looking for females. It's as simple as that.
Well, does this mean that females tend to be more monogamous?
Nothing is written in stone. One of the best examples of that is you think of the human female as being one of the more monogamous of the animal world. But if you go to the mountains, the highlands of Tibet, where the land has been divided up over generations, and where the plots are now so small that a single plot cannot sustain an entire family. There, women will marry two men and have their double plots sustain the family. The men happen usually to be brothers for good, solid genetic reasons. Mm-hmm. But still, it just goes to show how none of this is hardwired. So females do tend to be more monogamous than males, but they have good reason for doing that, in that they usually obtain no benefits from mating with more than one male. In fact, they can obtain benefits by being faithful to one male, by having him help provide for the offspring. Males tend to be more polygamous or more promiscuous than females, mm-hmm. because they can obtain these other benefits, more children.
Is this all about the female nurturing her young?
Yes, it's the fact that females can have fewer offspring than males can have, and that their reproductive strategy is to invest in those offspring. And they, in some species, they do it on their own. In others, they do it with the help of males. But their their true power in this world is to be able to select the male with whom they will mate. Because they are the more nurturing sex, they have this power to be choosy. And by, in doing that, they can shape the behavior of their mates.
Well, does this mean that the males are going out and finding the food then? That business about the males being the hunters and the gatherers to feed the family and feed the young?
In some species, that's a very useful activity of the males, but not all males can be shaped in that direction. You take sheep, for instance. There isn't a way that a ram could carry food back to its mate, right? So there's no way that a ewe could wait around and look for that feeding ram. Then
right.
she'd lose out on all mating opportunities. But in other species, such as bird species, many of the males tend to their young just as often and as diligently as the females do.
Well,
and that's because those females have shaped those males in that direction.
It's about women controlling men, I think. But I wonder, when you say that the women really focus on the food to nurture their young and nurture their bodies, does this have anything to do with why women have a harder time losing weight than men?
I think it probably does. I think it has to do with why women have so many more eating disorders than men. If you look at the fact that the only hoarders in the animal world are women. No males hoard food. Even in animals that store food on their bodies, women store much more food in the way of fat than males do. You've got to see that this is something that's just built into the females of the world, and that in some environments it's going to be a problem.
So I can say my hormones made me do it.
You can, that's right.
Susan, thank you.
You're welcome.
Susan Alport is a science writer and naturalist. She is author of Primal Feast, Food, Sex, Foraging, and Love. Writer Dory Greenspan writes award-winning cookbooks, works with a who's who list of chefs, and she loves test-driving kitchen equipment in her spare time. She reports on her tests in her Bon Appetit column, Tools of the Trade, and here at the Splendid Table. Hey, Dory, it's good to see you.
Hi, nice to be with you again.
You know, every time my husband and I open a bottle of wine and do not finish it, which, you know, does happen, I wonder about what is the best way to keep that wine.
Do you know, my husband and I have the same experience you do. You know, we open a bottle of wine and usually it's gone. But there are those times when there is wine left over and it's too good to pour into the jar that you're making vinegar with. And what you need to do to save wine is get the air out of the bottle.
Okay.
Pull the oxygen out. And there are two pretty neat wine savers that do that. One is called VacuVan. It's a vacuum pump, and it's about $10. Kit comes with a set of little rubber corks, stoppers that go into the bottle. The vacuum pump fits on top. You go pump, 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 pump. Out comes the air. And that'll keep wine for maybe up to 3 days or so. Actually, they have a new model called Concerto that's a little bit more sophisticated, ergonomic design, and I think it clicks or beeps when you've taken out as much air as you can take out. There are some people who swear by it and others who don't. There's also something called Private Preserve Wine Preserver. I dare you to say it three times. And it's just a bottle of inert gas. It's a combination of nitrogen, carbon dioxide, and argon. It's tasteless. It comes with a little straw, and you just spritz, fill the bottle with this inert gas, and recork it immediately. And that's really, a lot of professionals use that. It's $10 for the bottle. You can use it for about 120 saves, and that'll keep wine for days.
And there's no taste from the gas or no harm
no
that the
taste,
gas creates?
No inert gas. There's nothing that it just fills the space that would have had oxygen. It fills that space with this inert gas. And that's a pretty nifty, of course you have to remember to hold on to your cork, but that's a very good way of keeping wine. Of course, you can also invest $2,000 in one of those refrigerated cases that, you know, but that's a bigger commitment than I'm ready to make for my leftovers.
I'm sorry, I don't do that for my wine. But what about keeping the bubbles in the champagne?
Now we're really talking oxymoronic leftover champagne. But in fact, you know, years and years and years ago, a French friend of mine said to me, the way you keep bubbles in an open bottle of champagne is to put the stem of a sterling silver spoon into the bottle. And for years, I did that.
Uh-huh.
It didn't work very well, but I loved the idea that I could... None of my... This was so interesting to me because all of my French friends knew this trick. None of my American friends had ever heard about it. But just a couple of weeks ago, I was talking to Jacques Peters, who's the cellar master at Veuve Clicquot, and I said, you know, what about the silver spoon trick? And he said, everyone in France does it. He said, it doesn't really work. And they did real live tests. Evidently, your champagne will stay overnight. Some of the bubbles will stay whether or not you put a silver spoon in it. But you can keep your bubbles longer if you use a real champagne stopper. And there are a couple. Again, Vacuvin makes one that it's about $12, and it fits over the top and opens in such a way that it makes a spout, a pouring spout. And that'll keep your bubbles. Pedrini has a really good-looking one that costs $30, about the price of a bottle of champagne.
Mm-hmm.
But it has a rubber stopper. It has kind of these flyaway flanges that you lift up, put the rubber stopper in, and when you close it, it seals the bottle. And that'll keep the bubbles for a couple of days.
Well, okay, so we've got a couple of days out of all of this. Thanks.
Thanks. Enjoy those days.
Dory Greenspan's latest book is Paris Sweets. Her equipment column, Tools of the Trade, appears in Bon Appetit magazine. Nobody wants to be like everybody else all the time. I mean, you want to be separate from the pack in some special way. Now, some people do it in enormous ways, like Lance Armstrong. But then there are the unsung champions. Janice Ray, author of Wild Card Quilt, has the story of her brother, an unsung hero of the vegetable patch.
My brother Dale is a pipe fitter who's motivated mostly by his desire to get into the Guinness Book of World Records by growing tomatoes. Our family members are pretty competitive, I guess, eager to lord over each other. Last year we had a bet to see who could produce the first ripe tomato. I was watering mine extra and Daddy was pouring on the fertilizer, but it was Dale who plopped the first salmon pink fruit onto Mama's table. Dale had tomatoes almost year-round, until way about February when frost finally killed his plants. By March, he was planting starts again. This year, although I had tomatoes in the ground before he did, his bore first again. He had the biggest tomato, too, he said. Every time I saw him, he'd tell me I needed to go around and see his big tomato. It's still green and growing, and already bigger than anything I've ever grown. Don't count your chickens before they hatch, I warned. I don't think it'll break the world record, but I'm hoping, he said. It'll be close. What is the record? 7 pounds. I've seen big tomatoes before, I said, shrugging him off. I remember a German pink I bought at a fruit stand in North Carolina, big as a slice of bread. You gotta come see my big tomato, he said. It's monstrous. Finally, I rode over, and sure enough, it was the biggest tomato I'd ever seen. It was bigger than a big grapefruit. It's not even full grown yet, Dale said. It's starting to turn, which means it's still growing. It's still growing, Aunt Jean said. She's the wife of my uncle, Daddy's brother, who's dead. She's in her 70s, wears fashionable shoes, and has an elegant flair even in the way she holds her cigarettes. She loves to wear hats and is not stingy with bright makeup. Dale carries her around town the first of every month when her check comes to pay the bills and buy groceries. She's happy to have him growing vegetables in her yard. When I pick it, I'm going to leave a few inches of stem, Dale plans, for the weight. I'm going to take it down to the newspaper office and get a picture taken. Every time I saw my brother, he'd have an update. I've raised it onto straw, he said, to keep it off the ground. I need to rig a sling for it, like a cradle. You got a pair of torn pantyhose? Why a sling? To keep it from detaching and to keep it off the ground so it won't rot or get a bug. Bugs fly. Worms crawl. Come on, I have a pair of pantyhose I never wear. This'll put a pair to good use. A few days later, he said, it's not a world record, tomato, but it's close. Ain't nobody around here seen one any bigger. I measured it, and it's 13 inches circumference. Yep, it'll take y'all a long time to raise one that big, he gloated to me and Daddy. You'll spend the next 20 years trying to top that. He never did get to have his picture in the newspaper with his big tomato. Somehow he missed the worm that bored in from the underside, and he missed the start of rot, and when he finally decided to pick the fruit, which appeared perfect, it was spoiled beyond use. Most of its weight had drained right out the bottom. He tried to eat the blossom end, but rot had permeated the entire tomato. The following season, still lusting after glory, he tried the same variety in the same spot in Aunt Jean's yard. It barely produced. Dale still talks about his lost champion, lovingly and humorously. It'd fill up this bowl here, he said once, nodding toward a lathe-turned bowl holding wooden fruit on Mama's table. The bowl's maybe 10 inches across. You wish, I hooted. Dale grinned, humor me. What were you putting on it? Whatever I could find, sheep manure, 10-10-10, Miracle-Gro. No wonder it got so big, I said. It had thyroid problems from all the chemicals. It was a fluke, he said. A tomato like that comes once in a lifetime. Was that tomato symbolic in your life? I teased. It was my one hope of leaving this place, he said. The tomato, however, had served its purpose. Anybody who saw it was impressed, and it made my brother a hero among us, the people who matter. Even if Guinness never heard about it.
Writer and naturalist Janice Ray is author of Wild Card Quilt. She's based in Georgia. Well, right now, here in the Midwest, we are in the first flush of tomato madness. The purity stage. Now, that means you slice them, you salt them, and you don't fool around. But in another week, we are going to be ready for some variety, and then it's time for a salad straight out of 1800 Midwest Americana. Those big, sweet, ripe beefsteaks join up with crunchy, tart green tomatoes in a vinegar sugar dressing packed with garlic. I call the recipe Big Tomato Sweet Sour Salad, and you can get it on the website, splendidtable.org. Okay, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, this one comes from a listener's question, and here it is. What's the connection between guns and garlic? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. It's Target, now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle. Online at target.com/supertarget. We're going to be taking your calls in a minute. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what is the connection between guns and garlic? Well, the connection is stainless steel, which was invented in 1913 to keep gun barrels from corroding. I had no idea about this. Now, the garlic end of the connection is that stainless steel gets rid of the smell of garlic on your hands. You rub the garlic or onion-scented area over the stainless steel, rinse with water, and presto, no smells. The science here is that mix of metals or blend of metals that make up stainless steel catalytically enhance the oxidation of the odors. So once the smelly area has been rubbed on the steel, you can wash away any lingering scents in water. Now, if one piece of stainless fails, just try another, since each might be a slightly different blend of metals.
Hello.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render.
How'd you get my number?
To the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me.
The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to those phones. We have Henry on the line. Henry, what do you want to talk about?
I have always wondered, and I have looked everywhere to find out what, if anything, you can do with radish tops.
Oh, you can do a ton of things with them.
I didn't know if you had to parboil them. There are no recipes.
You know, I think it's because a lot of times when you buy radishes in the store, the tops are already kind of over the hill. But are you growing radishes?
Yes.
Oh, then you have got a great source. Okay, you can treat them any way that you would treat spinach.
All right.
What do they taste like? What do yours taste like?
Well, I've never eaten them because my husband and I have laughed because some, you know radishes can come in crop after crop.
Right.
And we couldn't find any information, so we were, you know, it could be like rhubarb, but we don't kill ourselves, you know.
No, you're not going to die. I promise you will not die. They have a kind of fuzziness to them.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say you can treat them the way you might treat spinach, I think the one way I'm not crazy about them is raw in salad. Some people are, but I'm not.
But you could.
But one thing that I've done with them when I can get them super fresh is I will take peppers and I'll roast them, you know, I'll cut them up,
mm-hmm.
and I'll roast them with a lot of garlic and onion, and I'll throw in some hot peppers,
mm-hmm.
and they're sweet, and so is the onion, right? I'll do this like at 450, because I want to get them a little bit, you know, just a tad of brown.
Mm-hmm.
You throw a handful of radish leaves in that mixture.
While it's in the oven.
Right, and the idea is, when you roast vegetables, I mean, this could be with carrots, it could be with anything, you toss them with a little olive oil, salt and pepper, whatever spices, throw in bitter leaves or tangy leaves, mm-hmm. like radish leaves. Now, you want them actually to crisp, and they are a fabulous contrast.
All right.
Yeah, to the sweet peppers and the onions. The other thing that's really great to do with radish leaves is when you're making sandwiches in the summer,
mm-hmm.
and you slather on the mayo,
mm-hmm.
and the mustard, and maybe you put, you know, some cold meats on the sandwich, throw on, instead of arugula, throw on the radish leaves.
Oh, that's good. Oh, I'm so glad.
Yeah, try it. Just, you
I
know,
will.
And I'd say nibble on them and see, because some kinds of radishes, the leaves tend to be stronger, some they're very mild, mm-hmm. some are fuzzy, some are not.
Mm-hmm. Well, if I get any good recipes worked up, I'll call you back.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Okay, you can reach us at 800-537-5252. We have Heather calling. Heather, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Well, I have a question about mint. I bought a house about 4 years ago and inherited a great patch of mint and have been trying to think of ways to use it. I have put it in lemonade and done some things like that. But
right.
I'm thinking particularly about preserving it somehow.
Huh, now that's an interesting... You know, one thing you can do with it is that you can just freeze it.
Yeah?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's going to get dark. It's never going to be fresh again, but you'll keep the bright, fresh flavor. And then if you want to use it in sauces or in marinades, you know, like for instance, you're doing Greek cooking and you want to marinate chunks of lamb for kebabs with garlic and mint and a little bit of olive oil and some lemon zest. Well, if the mint is fresh, it's fine. But if the mint is just coming out of the freezer, it's just as fine because it's all going to be cooked anyway. So you see what I'm saying? That wherever you think of how you use mint, where it gets darkened anyway, you could use frozen mint.
Okay, great. What about mint sauce? I know we used to have mint sauce when I was a kid, and we'd have leg of lamb for Christmas dinner.
Yeah.
Can you do that and preserve it?
Well, yeah, you could. What you can do is essentially take equal parts of sugar and water, and maybe a pinch of salt, and boil that until it's clear, and throw a ton of mint into that, okay? And then you can freeze it.
Oh, wow, that's great.
And you know what you do? Freeze it in ice cube trays, and then break out the cubes, stick them in a plastic bag, and whenever you want mint sauce, you can take it by 2 tablespoonfuls.
Oh, that's
so
wonderful.
You know, you can use it over sweets, you can use it in savory things, too.
Great.
I don't think you have enough mint now for all these ideas. You're going to have to plant mint.
Oh, I don't know. That sounds dangerous.
No lawn, only mint.
It'll smell great.
Hey, you take care.
All right, thanks.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Call us, guys. We are at 800-537-5252. We've got Jill on the line. So, Jill, what do you want to talk about? Your turn.
I am looking for a fabulous sort of dessert for a Spanish-influenced dinner party.
Ooh.
Yeah.
And the guiding force there is fabulous.
Fabulous. But I also want something I can make ahead and maybe just have a couple, 15, 20 minutes of prep time in the kitchen.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that doesn't you know, negate fabulous. We can do fabulous. Tell me what the menu is, though.
Valencia-style paella and a... shrimp and cilantro pesto quesadillas, and then mojitos and sangria, and a big bowl of fruit.
Oh, this sounds glorious.
Yeah.
Well, now let me think first. Okay. Friend of mine spends a lot of time in Spain, and there are two things I'm remembering. One is peaches and red wine.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
And it was interesting because the way she described it, because she makes it, is that you take really great peaches. You probably could do it with nectarines or plums, too. She makes a sugar syrup, like one part liquid to 1.5 parts sugar, something like that, with cinnamon and lemon in it.
Wow.
Yeah. And she just takes the raw fruit and she puts that in it in the fridge for 2 days. Then, and she makes a lot of the syrup.
So I just infuse the syrup with the cinnamon and the lemon zest?
Well, when you're cooking, when you're boiling down the syrup, when you're boiling, what you have to do is boil the sugar and water together. So let's say it's 1.5 cups of sugar to 1 cup of water. All right. It's a very dense syrup. And then within that, you would have a generous amount of cinnamon and you'd have lemon peel. Or even cut up lemons. And you'd simmer that until it's clear. And then you would just immerse the cut up or half peaches. She did it with these big, delicious peaches. And let it sit in the fridge for 2 days. Then take away half the syrup and substitute red wine and let it sit another 2 days. And then you serve the fruit. She served the fruit in wine glasses, like cut in wedges, with the syrup drizzled over it.
Wow.
And big, big bunches of, she had lemon balm and things like that. But, you know, fresh herbs stuck in.
That sounds amazing.
It was fabulous and it was cool, not ice cold. All I remember was, I mean, I've poached fruit in wine, but this had a completely different flavor.
Oh, fantastic.
And the other thing I remember was fresh goat cheese tarts
little tartlets, like a, you know, a sweet crust, again with lemon in it, and then fresh goat cheese that had been mixed with honey and sugar and citron.
Wow. And we have a great goat dairy cheese producer right down the street, so that'll be fantastic.
Oh, this would be great. And then if you serve those to nibble on with the peaches and red wine, I think that would be utterly, well, to borrow your word, I think
it would be
fabulous, and you do it all ahead.
Oh, that's great.
So
that's exactly what I was thinking of.
Take a cheesecake recipe and substitute the fresh goat cheese, and you may want to use, and taste it. See what it tastes like. You may want to use a tad more sugar than a normal cheesecake recipe.
Wow.
I think it'd be, oh gosh, that would be good.
Could I make a lemon curd cheesecake?
Why not?
Oh, any excuse to make lemon curd.
Well, exactly. And the cheesecake police are not coming to your house. I would not worry about this.
Oh, good.
Hey, Jill, have a great dinner.
I will. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Yeah, this is the time of year for fresh goat cheese, guys. And you don't have to use it just for savory things. You add sugar or honey. How about lavender honey, fresh lavender? Mix that in with the fresh goat cheese and just make little balls. And maybe just tuck that, you know, on top of some fresh cut up fruit and berries. All right. Call us. 800-537-5252. We've got Kit calling. Kit, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
Well, I am so glad to hear from you.
You sound like a woman with a problem. What's up?
Every conceivable vessel an inch of my counter space is filled with little green apples.
Well, this sounds quite lovely.
Well, usually I get these wonderful plump apples that I can cook and freeze and use for pies and sauces and jams. And this year, we had the most prolific crop, but they only ended up being an inch and a half to about 2 inches, you know.
In diameter? I'll be darned.
And what the rabbits don't eat and the squirrels and, you know, the birds and things, I get. But this is ridiculous, you know. And I used to live in India for years, and they take the little green mangoes that come off the tree.
Right.
And they, green mango pickle, relish, chutney, blah, blah. And I was hoping that you would have an idea for like an apple chutney.
Oh, sure. Green tomatoes and these apples.
Oh.
Equal parts of it. And take the spicing, your mango chutney. You have a recipe for that green mango?
It's sitting in front of me, and it's got things like, and since it came from India, it's got things like fresh gingerly oil and coconut oil, which, of course, we don't really get those. So I'm not sure. It's got mustard, fenugreek.
That's good. That's
red
good.
Chilies.
That's
hello.
Right. And you want
curry leaves.
All
I'm
right.
sorry.
No, you want red chili. You want the mustard. You want the mustard seeds.
Okay.
You want garlic. Okay, you want equal parts of vinegar and sugar. Okay, you want equal. You want some green tomatoes with your green apples.
This sounds really exciting.
This is great. Now, what you're going to do is you're going to take the sugar and you're going to take spices, and you can spice to taste, and the vinegar.
Okay.
You're going to simmer that, all right, for about 15 or 20 minutes, and then you're going to drop in the apples and the green tomatoes, and you are going to cook it for about a half hour, and you will have sterilized jars.
Okay.
And you will pack it into those sterilized jars.
Now, and, this is really wonderful.
And they just remember, equal parts of vinegar and sugar. Okay.
You know what? This is a wonderful idea because you have no idea how many apples I'm looking at.
I have a vague sense, but I would still try the vanilla cinnamon apple pie just for fun.
Yes, we'll split it in two, okay? And I will call you back and let you know how it turned out.
Okay. Hey, thanks for calling.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome.
Bye.
Goodbye. This could have been worse. She could have been looking at a sea of zucchini. You know how you're constantly hearing about these chili eating contests? Well, in the realm of chili madness called Mine is Hotter Than Yours, there is actually a chili sauce that was banned from the Fiery Food Show for being too hot. Now, it was created by Dave Hirschkopf, who is the author of a book called Crazy from the Heat. And we have Dave on the phone. So, Dave, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Tell me about this sauce and what was in it.
Insanity sauce is, it's you know, straightforward tomato sauce, of course, but we added a little bit of a chili extract, which is an insanely hot ingredient that makes it a phenomenally hot sauce.
Is that chili extract that substance that actually develops inside the chili that creates the heat?
Yeah, capsaicin is the substance inside of chilies, and we use a diluted form of it because by itself you need a special permit to even have that.
Really?
Yeah.
So, you know, I realize this may be a silly question, but why did you create this sauce?
Well, I used to own a restaurant, and we got a lot of drunk college kids in there. So I found out that giving them something a little bit too hot was terrific crowd control.
So they were speechless, stunned, and could not move, right?
Well, they either couldn't move or they moved very fast out the door. Either of which was an acceptable solution to me.
Well, you know, you're always hearing about this business that hotter is better. And I've always wondered, is this a sort of testosterone kind of thing? And can you taste when you get into food that's this hot?
Well, we you know, we make things to please a number of groups, but amongst the group that the hotter is the better, certainly there are people whose tolerance is such that they can eat extremely hot foods and still taste. But really, your brain can only accept so much input. And so if your pain receptors are sending so much information to your brain, it's sometimes hard for your brain to really get all the taste information also.
Mm-hmm. So, Dave, what do you do? What are your antidotes when you've eaten something that really is too hot?
Well, there's lots of things that are recommended, you know, dairy products, sugars, starches, bread, et cetera. I find that for something really, really hot, the only thing that's really effective is basically ice cream or something extremely cold. And you just keep it in there for 15 minutes until the pain sort of passes.
So you mean something creamy and something cold?
Well, the creaminess is a nice helper, but it's the cold that really is the effective part.
Okay, so, you know, ice, anything from ice water to iced tea to, as you said, ice cream.
Water and things like that generally make it worse. Now, if the water was so incredibly freezing cold and you could keep the water in your mouth for 15 minutes, then that might be effective. But by and large, something like ice itself or ice cream or frozen yogurt or something
okay.
like that.
Hey, Dave, thank you.
Sure.
Dave Hirschkopf is author of Crazy from the Heat Cookbook. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with our annual quote from Garrison Keillor. He said, "People have tried and they have tried, but sex is not better than sweet corn." The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. You know, you can find everything you heard here today, and even things you didn't hear here today, on our website, splendidtable.org. And you can also find our free newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to make your weeknight cooking a little easier. Now, you register for it online at splendidtable.org. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Sarah Lear and Judy Graham. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week and join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Public Radio International.